on the AM/FM 24/7 radio network.
We don't have time for that again today. We are going to go ahead and get started. School for Startups Radio, thank you so much for being with us. First up today, we have Dave Burnett, AOK Marketing. He bought 3,000 URLs. That's the beginning of the story. And then Adam Torres is with us. 6,000 interviews on his show with 35 employees. Two amazing stories. We're going to get started right now because we're almost there. Boy, I have an interesting story to share with you and a great guest. Please welcome Dave Burnett to the show. He was a hockey enforcer during school. I don't really know what a hockey enforcer is, but it sounds just mean as hell, chasing scholarships and trying to get through school. Listen to this. He had a college beer sampling side gig thing. I don't really know what beer sampling means. Isn't that just another euphemism for getting drunk? Anyway, he turned it into a 50-person business. Unbelievable. Later, he was co-founder of Achievers.com, which he sold for $110 trillion. I bet that's a typo. I bet that's supposed to be million. Anyway, along the way, though, he had some bad things happened. He had a really bad injury that we will probably talk about. And at one point, he was spending $70,000 of his own dollars to keep a company alive. That's not fun. He has gotten through all of that and put all of that knowledge into his latest called AOK Marketing, which has got some really cool new tools for helping us on the AI side of marketing. It's going to be interesting. Dave, welcome to the show. How you doing?
Thanks so much for having me, Jim. I'm doing well. And yes, to answer your earlier question, it was a lot about getting drunk. But the business I had back in the day was something where if you've ever gone into Costco and seen those people giving out free samples of food.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We did that, except for beer brands and liquor brands here in Ontario. So I'm based out of Toronto. So we were able to do that. Yeah, we were able to do that here. So that's what we did.
Very smart. I love it. I don't think that's legal here in Georgia, in the States.
Yeah, it's not legal in many places, but here there's some kind of loophole in things where you can actually, somebody gets out of their car, you can give them a shot of liquor when they walk into the liquor store, and it's completely legal. So I don't get it either, but it was a lot of fun, and I'm sure everybody back when I was in college just liked me for my personality. It wasn't the fact that I had, you know, an entire minivan full of beer or a truck full of alcohol. I'm sure it was my personality. Nothing to do with the free booze, for sure.
And your good looks.
And my good looks. This is a radio interview, so I could say whatever I wanted about my good looks, couldn't I?
That's right. Well, there's a reason we're on radio and no video here, I promise you, so...
Yeah, I hear you.
There was a reason for that. I didn't want to have to get, pretty every day. So now I just found your picture. Dude, I'm completely heterosexual, but you're, good looking guy with a lot of hair and stuff. You belong on the high def TV. So.
Well, that's kind of you to say. I appreciate that, but we'll stick to radio for now. How does that sound?
What was Achievers.com?
So Achievers.com was the first online incentive company. So basically you work for a company, you would get points, and then you could take those points and redeem them online for gifts, like a blender or a lawnmower or something like that. So that's what we did. We were the very first people to actually take that online back in 2000. And so we had clients like GE and some of the banks and things to get that off the ground. So that was a lot of fun and started that back then. And it had a good run.
Kind of like a blue book in the old days.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much like a blue book in the old days, except we digitized it. So
exactly, yes.
Being one of the first people to go online was a huge advantage back then. It looks obvious and there's lots of different points programs now, but back in the day, it was quite the change, quite the innovation.
And who'd you sell it to?
So I actually exited the business in 2002, and the business continued on to sell into private equity And then the private equity sold it again in 2015, not for, you know, what did you say, $110 trillion? I'm pretty sure it was not that, but it was definitely $110 million.
Yes, I corrected myself.
So that was, yes. Yeah, exactly. So it sold to a private equity firm that's still running it today, and they're having great success. So I wish them all the best.
Excellent, excellent. Good story and great experience. How did that play into AOK? What did you do after you walked away with your big payday? Did you consider just buying a lake house and an ocean house and plane to fly between them?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where the stories are always better than the actual reality. You know, because you get into private equity and because there's a bunch of different shareholders, the actual amount that you walk away with, and especially because I left the business back in 2002 before those big exits happened, you don't end up with nearly as much money as the big headline says that you do. So I actually started up another business, and you'd mentioned the losing $70,000. I was actually losing $70,000 a month in 2007, 2008, when the Great Recession happened. So I started up a promotional products company that's now called promotionalproducts.com. And when the Great Recession happened, nobody was giving out free stuff, no t-shirts, no mugs, nothing was happening. So back in 07, 08, I had lots of people working for me, salespeople and other things. So the overheads associated with that was $70,000 a month. And that wasn't really sustainable. So I took that experience, went out and realized I had to get good at digital marketing. So I took that moment to go out and register 3,000 URLs, so 3,000 website addresses, and then I put up 500 websites.
Let me interrupt before. Isn't that like $20 a pop?
Yes. Yeah. Well, it wasn't 20 because I bought so many. It was more like 10, but yes, okay. It was not cheap.
Who did you buy those through? Not
I bought them through GoDaddy. Yeah, GoDaddy.com.
Oh, really?
That's who I bought them through.
Okay.
Yeah. They have an accounts team that works with people who are doing big purchases like that. So I went and bought those. Yeah. So I went and bought those, and then I put up 500 websites on those URLs, and that became our lead generation source. Having all these different websites, all these different areas online where people could find us. And that really turned into something good over the years.
So 500 sites doing what?
So we were promoting promotional products at the time.
Okay. So
if you wanted to buy t-shirts,
pens.
Yep, absolutely. But what we registered were local websites. So I owned promotional products, Seattle.com and promotional products, Toronto and promotional products, Atlanta and promotional products, you name it is what I owned. So I registered all the domains for every place in the US and Canada that had a population of over 50,000 people. So every single incorporated city, I own promotional products, thatcity.com. So that's how I went out and bought so many of those at the time. Now, the one thing that you got to keep in mind is that every year you got to pay that $10 again.
That's right. No, it's not so, free.
No, it's definitely not free.
What are your thoughts on that? Paying
it made sense.
2,500 that aren't up.
Yeah, no, the other 2,500 that aren't up was a competitive protection, right? It was so other people couldn't do what I had done. If they were going to copy my strategy, I wanted to own the primary domain for that city, that town, that state, whatever it might be. So I kept them going, and it worked out. I mean, you just got to do the math. And you know, if you get so many orders from whatever websites you've got, you end up making some money. So I also own promotionalproducts.com in the US and promotionalproducts.ca for Canada. And those are primary websites that generate most of the revenue. But there's money that still comes in from that network of websites. 18 years later.
The long tail.
It was a good decision. It was a very long tail. Absolutely.
Wow.
And so, that's what happened. So, yeah, but what happened and where AOK Marketing comes in was in 2010, because we had all these websites and I'd done SEO to all of them, people were finding us online. So my competitors actually came to me and said, "Hey, can you do that for me? Can you help us get found online?" And so we did. we ended up doing that. I mean, I'll tell you the truth. We said no to the first five or six, but then eventually I learned. And so having learned, we did that for others. And that's how my digital marketing business, AOK Marketing, got started, was through consumer, you know, customer demand. So
how are you able to do that for them? If what did they buy? Promotional fun products, Atlanta.com?
Yeah. No, they usually own their own website, like BobSmithsPromo.com or like some random name that was their brand name.com.
So what was the strategy? And there? We helped that them. Strategy wouldn't work. Or did you buy their brand name plus Atlanta.com?
No, so we didn't do the regional strategy for anybody else. That was part of the reason why we could do it for other people, because we were dominating that side of the strategy. But what we did for them was more traditional SEO. So traditional SEO comes down to three main things. It's the technical side of your website. How, like, can the machines read your website or not? The second thing is the content on your website. And the third thing is backlinks. So other websites linking to your website. So we were able to help people with their traditional SEO and get them found online. And that's what started that side of the business. Then we got into paid search, paid social, digital marketing side of things. And then now we're doing SEO AI or GEO or AEO or whatever you want to call it. We're now helping people get found in ChatGPT and in Google Gemini and Claude, all those different things.
All right. Started to have this conversation recently on the show. About a month ago, we started talking about search engine optimization for AI. So before we go there, though, let me ask a couple of things. Is traditional SEO going to become less relevant? And I think another way of asking this question is Google finally going to die? Does AI finally make Google irrelevant? I've quit searching because AI just gives me the answer instead of searching, and then it'll give me the source. I don't usually care, you know? So where are we? Is this the thing that a lot of us have been praying for, that there will finally be some way that Google can lose its dominance?
Yeah. I mean, we've been pretty spoiled. I look at it that we've been pretty spoiled for the last 20 years that we had one place to go to for all that information. And now the search market is getting fragmented. There's ChatGPT and all the others, but it got fragmented back in the late 2000s with social. I mean, people search on YouTube for stuff. They search on TikTok for stuff. They search on Facebook for stuff. So search is just getting more and more fragmented. So to answer your question, do I think it's going to kill Google? No, they've got way too much money, and so they're going to continue to pivot and innovate. They also have a ton of information from all those 20 years of searches that people have done. So they have a really good foundation to build off of.
You think they're not going to start a blackmailing business?
Well, they're going to start something. They're certainly going to be able to pivot. I mean, if you remember back in the day, BlackBerry. Remember BlackBerry's going completely back in the day?
Oh yeah.
They still exist. BlackBerry as a company still exists because they ended up making so much money off their devices. They had $2 billion in the bank or something. So they're still around. They're now a cybersecurity company, but they're still around as an example. So I don't know what Google is going to potentially pivot or change into. But right now what AI is doing is it's taking away a lot of the informational searches. So there's four kinds of searches you can have. You can have informational, so you're looking for stuff. Navigational, you're looking to go somewhere. Commercial, you're curious about a business. Or transactional, you want to buy something. So right now, AI is taking over all the informational searches. It's starting to get more and more into the other types of searches. But if you want to find, you know, like, for example, if you put in restaurant near me, if you did that in ChatGPT, ChatGPT doesn't necessarily know where you are, know where you stand, know where you exist. So you still sometimes have to go back to Google for that. And if you want to know where to buy something, ChatGPT is about to integrate with Shopify, and it already does with Etsy. But still, if you're looking to buy something, you usually got to either go to that person's website or that company's website, or you got to go to Google. So it's still there, it's still relevant, and it's still got lots of searches happening. So is it changing? Absolutely. Are they going to die? I think they're just going to change and pivot with the times. That's my 10 cents anyways.
All right. Very, very interesting. So how are you talking to your customers about that and telling them, how do you position your customers for that AI transition?
Well, we talked a little bit about traditional SEO, right? It's technical SEO, content, and backlinks. That's really all about getting one page, a page on your website to rank. So say, for example, you were Starbucks and you wanted your Frappuccino page to rank. That's traditional SEO to get a page to rank on the traditional Google search results. What SEO for AI or GEO or AEO, whatever you want to call it.
What's the G is, there you're saying?
Oh, so the GEO is generative engine optimization.
Okay, all right. I've had this conversation with other people. What the hell are we going to call it? No one seems to know.
Yeah, GEO and AEO seem to be winning. AEO is artificial intelligence engine optimization. And the AIEO, eventually we'll figure out what to call it. But I just think GEO is the easiest. So that's generative engine optimization.
Shouldn't we ask them what they want us to call it? And by them, I mean our new overlords, dictators.
Yeah, absolutely. You can ask.
They've promised me.
They did promise me that too. You can ask Sam Altman, who is the leader of the benevolent crew over there at OpenAI and ChatGPT. I don't know what he's calling it. But as soon as he decides to call it something, I'm sure that's what everybody will stick to.
I have Sam Altman down as the most likely Bond supervillain of all of them. He's the one that to me seems the most likely to be truly a Bond supervillain.
That's interesting. Well, if I may ask, what made you come to that conclusion that he would be the most likely given things like Google's history and others?
You know, there's so many candidates, Zuckerberg with his, 50,000 square foot underground thing that he's doing in Hawaii and all of that. But I saw Tucker Carlson interview Sam, and Sam, he asked about the engineer that died and an open AI engineer that died. And Sam was talking about how he was his good friend and everything. And Carlson basically accused him to his face of, you killed him. And he did a very bad job of denying it. And the only thing that was missing, Dave, was the white cat.
Okay. Well,
have you seen that interview? You should check that one out.
I have not seen that interview. I'm getting a vision of Dr. Evil with the white cat, or I guess Dr. No, if we're going to go right back in time to the James Bond villain.
All the way to the back guy. But, yeah, the guy with no hands.
I did not see that interview. So
they have so much power over things now. So anyway, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. I'll it disappeared. So, Dave, I, as a small guy who can't afford 10 different retainers with 10 different marketing companies, what do I do in this AI world? I mean, GEO world. What do I do?
Yep. No, it's an excellent question. So, I talked about traditional SEO being those three things, which is technical SEO, content, and backlinks to and getting page authority. To become known in AI, you need to have what we call entity authority. So having your brand, your product, your website become an authority on its own, and that authority being reinforced through third-party media is an easy way to do it. So, for example, your radio show. If you're on the radio show and, say, for example, that gets changed into a podcast, and then that podcast goes onto Spotify, and then there is a transcript there talking about the information that you and I are talking about. That publicly verifiable information is a great source for GEO. So you need five other things when you're actually trying to get found on GEO. You need PR, You need directories. So you need to have your information correct everywhere, basically, is what that means. Ideally, you would have a Wikipedia page, and you would have Reddit comments and things like that. And you would have a knowledge graph. And a knowledge graph is just more technical SEO. And what it actually does is it shows the machine how you relate to other things. So if you get the shortest answer is how to get found in AI, honestly, is to do cool things, talk about the cool things you've done, and then do more cool things enough for the fact that other people start talking about the cool stuff you're doing. And then the AI models will find you because you've got PR, because you're on these podcasts, because you've got people talking about you on Reddit, because you might get a Wikipedia page, because your website is notable. All these different things all go into your public footprint. And that footprint is what AI uses to decide whether or not you're trustworthy, whether or not you've got authority, whether you've got expertise, any of those things to be able to be found on the AI machines. So even the small guys can do it. If the small guys are doing something cool, then they should talk about it and they should have people, other people talk about it as well.
Damn it, Dave. I didn't hear a single thing. Like, if you hold your shift down while you hit enter, you get double the points now on AI. In other words, yeah, what I heard is keep doing the stuff I've already been doing.
Yeah.
It's just best practices, right? It's just keep doing the best practices.
Yeah. A lot of people think there's a lot of magic to SEO, a lot of secret sauce, a lot of if you try and do this, do that, you'll get shown.
I've heard if you do black text on black backgrounds, it's awesome for your SEO.
That would have been good in 2011. Or 2010. We're about 15 years beyond that. Lots of people got caught for that, for sure. And then what happens is Google changes the rules or identifies that, and I call it the Google slap or the Facebook slap. All of a sudden, they change the rules, and you have to adjust. And I've been doing this for 20 years, and maybe I'm just getting too grizzled in my 20-year history of doing this, but instead of chasing the latest fad in how to get found in AI, as you said, just do the fundamentals, do the right things, do something that's cool, do something that's fun, do something that people will actually talk about. I mean, okay, if you run something like an accounting firm, you can still do cool stuff. You can be like, this new law just happened, and by doing these three things, you can legally save on your taxes or something like that. That's cool. That's cool stuff. You found a new innovative way to save people money. Talk about that. If you clean cars, talk about your new technique, talk about the cool products you use. If you have a restaurant, all your new innovative dishes, whatever you serve. I mean, there's so much cool stuff that's happening that nobody talks about because they think they need to hold down the shift key while pressing enter and standing on one foot and wearing blue. It's a little ridiculous, to be honest.
Dave, we are running out of time, but I just made a mental list of all the things we still need to ask you about, and we're in trouble. Limtel.
Yep.
Tell me.
Limtel, it's LLMTEL.com. That's Large Language Model Intelligence. And what it does is it actually shows you what and how you rank on the AI machine. So what we just talked about, you can just enter in your website in Limtel. It's free. You can get three free AI reports. You just enter in your website. It'll ask you some questions. It'll verify your information. And then it'll just show you how you show up in the models across 17 different models. So not only ChatGPT, but also Claude and DeepSeek whole bunch of others that'll actually be able to show you how you rank. So it's a great tool that we've invented. Yeah.
Dave, what do you want to tell us about your personal struggles that you've gone through? We have pretty much established that you are the king of the hill here in this. What do you want to tell us about the personal struggles you've gone through?
Well, everything when you're going to be an entrepreneur, and I've been an entrepreneur now for more than 25 years, everything's a struggle. But I look at it as you kind of have to choose your hard. you choose hard if you decide to go and work for somebody else for minimum wage and just struggle to get by. Or you choose hard if you become an entrepreneur because everybody's looking at you and the buck stops here and you might have to put somebody else's paycheck on your credit card one day. There are all kinds of hard out there. It just depends on which hard you choose. And sometimes the hard gets dealt to you. And, you know, I know you mentioned that I was a hockey enforcer earlier on, but that not nearly as bad as it sounds. But I actually suffered a traumatic brain injury back in 2018 that I don't remember 2019 and half of 2020. And so my goal in those days was just to get through the day, just to get to the next day. And so if you can take the time to focus your effort and just do something that makes you 1% better today than you were yesterday, in the course of a year, you're going to be much, much farther ahead just by focusing on that one thing. So I've been through a lot. I'm sure everybody listening to this has been through their own stuff. My story is no more notable than theirs. And my story should be something that shows you that even if you can't remember a year and a half, you can still succeed. You can still carry on, learn about the things that you want to learn about, and do whatever you want to do. You just have to have the drive and not give up. Because that's the thing. This is an infinite game that we're playing. And what I mean by an infinite game is the only way that you lose is when you give up. Entrepreneurship is a game that you lose when you give up. So, you know, it's not like a hockey game or a football game where there's a start date, a specific amount of time, and specific rules about how you win or lose. The infinite game of business, the infinite game of life, you just got to keep playing. So that's the philosophy I have about that.
Wow, Dave, incredibly well said. I think a lot of people would love to forget those particular years, and not to make light of what happened to you, but thank you for sharing that with us. And your attitude is incredible. And so just inspirational. Dave, thank you so much for being with us. It's great information. Really enjoyed learning from you. How do we find out more, get in touch, follow you online, all of that, please?
Yeah, so you can find me, main places, LinkedIn. Just look me up for Dave Burnett on LinkedIn. I'm also on X, which is Dave Burnett, all one word with an underscore, but that's just really kind of thoughts that I put out there. And then aokmarketing.com is the other place where you can find me. But, you know, it's been a real pleasure to be here. And you know, don't you have a game that you sometimes play with your clients too, or you're the people on your call?
I do, yes.
Are we up for that? Do we still have time to be able to squeeze that in?
We're going to do that separately. So say goodbye.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on the call.
Thank you,
on
Dave.
The call.
You were great. We will talk again soon.
Okay. Thank
and
you.
We will Bye-bye. Be right back. We are back. And again, thank you so very much for being with us. Very excited to introduce my first guest today. Please welcome Adam Torres to the show. He is the Mission Matters guys. He has a whole bunch of books named Mission Matters for each particular industry. It's really cool and useful the way he's divided it up. And he also has, of course, a podcast of that name. And he is the co-founder of Mission Matters, a media PR agency. He has a new book out called 1 Billion Podcast, The Future of All Media. Adam, welcome. How you doing?
Oh man, I'm so excited. I've been out doing this promo. I'm excited. We've had a ton of success, and I'm just excited at the way it's all been received. So I'm happy to be here too. I've been waiting to get on your show for a while now. I'm a fan.
I'm sorry. Yes, we're just so slow and lazy here, you know.
You got demand. It's all good. I love it.
So tell me about the book, 1 Billion Podcast. What's all that number refer to? And the future of all media. Just walk me through the whole thing.
So I'll tell you, earlier this year, so in January, I started guesting for the first time ever. And I mean, I just for some context, I've been in the business now 9 years as a podcaster. I've done over 6,000 interviews. This year, I'll do over 1,500 interviews. And every year, I do over 1,000 interviews, essentially, since I've gotten serious about this game. And one of the top things that people always are asking me in doing this, they're like, oh, should we start a podcast? Or, but, oh, it's saturated, or oh, this, oh, that. And I'm telling you, like, every show as a podcast expert, people would ask me that. And I'm like, I realize that people just don't even understand the business. They don't understand the game. They don't understand what podcasting even is when it comes to the business opportunity. We're essentially, if you think about YouTube, over 150 million channels, depending on where you get your data from. Podcasting, only about 4 million, depending on, again, where you get your data from. Only in the last couple of, like, one day, there will be podcasting. There's going to be 100 million. There's going to be 200 million. There's going to be a ton of podcasts out there. We're basically in like year one of YouTube. And through the book, I go through and my thesis, why and how I believe this growth is going to happen. And I also address the elephant in the room, which is, why hasn't the growth happened yet? Why are there only 4 million podcasts? So this book is, 9 years of my being in this business, studying this business, and putting it all in between some pages. And it's all original thought. I wrote it myself. I'm very proud to say I didn't use Ghostwriter, even though I have in the past, and I'm not against a Ghostwriter, but this was all me.
Why do so many fail? Why are there only 4 million podcasts, Adam?
Oh, I'm glad I say the setup, man. In order to understand that, I like to juxtapose, and in the book, I make this comparison between this and YouTube. And in YouTube, when you look at their early growth, they had something called their YouTube Partners Program. What was that Partners Program? That Partners Program allowed for dynamic advertising. So what that meant was, if you were to have a, if you were to release an episode, you could monetize that episode far into the future. And you as a creator, you didn't have to do anything. You didn't have to go out and sell ads. You didn't have to start a company and start looking for sponsors. YouTube, if you join their program, would automatically let you monetize the channel and put ads up there. And guess what? They put new ads up there when they got new advertisers. So you never have to worry. So you could year over year monetize videos that you did years ago without doing anything. That was not the case for podcasting. Podcasting came out of radio. So I want to focus on the smaller creator. If you were a smaller creator in the beginning of podcasting, it's been around like 23 years, depending on where you get your data from. Let's call it 23 years. You couldn't monetize your show. And even if you could monetize your show, you had to do what was known as a host read ad, which comes out of radio. It's baked into the episode. So what happens is, let's say you're fortunate and somebody gives you $100, some local business owner gives you $100. They want you to read an ad on your podcast. Well, guess what? Once you did that, you weren't going to get any more advertising. That's it. That episode's done. You made $100. And so dynamic advertising didn't really exist in the podcasting space for many, many years. It's a pretty recent introduction to where even small creators can actually benefit from that. The big guys, they always had it. There's ad networks, there's other things like that out there to where the big guys, they had the technology, they had the know-how, they had the staff, they could do that and they could monetize with dynamic advertising. Any of the small creators, the medium-sized creators didn't even exist. So now, once this shift to dynamic advertising has happened, about, depending on where you get your data from, about 80% of advertising revenue now from podcasting comes from dynamic ads. And that's just beginning. That's just beginning to get real adoption, to where these small shows can focus on only creating content and getting paid to do that, just like YouTube was in the beginning.
So how is that happening? Explain it. Where is that happening, Adam?
That's happening on many platforms. So now you as a creator, and I don't know if you have or not, but for example, I'll give you one example just for one. And then I have no affiliation with this company, just so you know, they're not paying me to say their name. But for example, Buzzsprout, they have an ad network. So let's say that you're a new podcaster, you go to Buzzsprout or you go to, we use a different one, but you go to, let's just say Buzzsprout, and then you sign up for, their service. You can monetize that one. Last I checked, as of, I guess this is November 2025, we're recording this. You could have as little as 1,000 downloads and start monetizing and start getting, and the pennies start rolling in. That never existed before. So now when you combine that with also the adoption of just the adoption of podcasting in other countries, as they're brought online, as these ad networks change, as these opportunities expand to more people are going to be introduced to the space, I believe, for even for the monetary side of things too, as well, just like YouTube.
So how are all the different ways that you're monetizing your show? Kind of just walk us through the whole galaxy of Adam.
Absolutely. So in the book, I actually go through this, and this is definitely 100% a tell-all book. So I show my entire playbook. I show how I built things. I even talk about some of the revenue lines that I'm not yet confident enough to write about, such as going international and monetizing internationally for in-person appearances and for in-person events, which I've just begun doing. I just did a gig in Singapore. I have one coming up in Abu Dhabi, and if this book is ever updated, then I'll add a section that I don't consider myself an expert in that yet. But in terms of how to monetize your show, the first thing I like to do is to kind of give the reader a little bit of a mindset change. Like a lot of people, I don't know how or why. I come from a finance background, first of all. So I was in finance for almost 14 years. And I can tell you, people paid for my time. When I go to the dentist, guess what? I got to pay for his time. When I go to the lawyer, I pay for his time. For some reason, I don't know where or how this has come in the podcast industry, because I'm not from that. But for some reason, I don't feel like many people feel they're supposed to be paid for their time. So I was never of that sort. So even from the beginning, even before we had a single download, I was thinking about this as a business and how to make money far above just your normal CPM or charging for a download. If your value, if somebody's listening to this and they think that their true value in this business and in this game is just how many downloads they have, they're completely missing the boat. And I write about this in the book. So to give you a couple of them to list, the first thing that I did is I'm thinking about how do I add value. When you think about the supply of podcasts, there aren't that many versus the supply of businesses. There's way more businesses that need media, marketing, branding than there are podcasts in existence. I already told you how many there were. There's not that many. So the beginning stage was really simple. It was, you know, I knew some business owners and I would charge at very small amounts, like $100, let's call it. I don't know what the original price was, but let's say it's $100. I'm going to bring you on. You're a business owner. Let's talk about your business. I was pretty successful doing that in the beginning. And, you know, somebody asked you, well, how many downloads? What's your reach? Our downloads, I just started it. I don't have that many downloads. What's my reach? Not many people. But guess what? Not everybody said yes, but a lot of people did say yes. So that was initial revenue day one on that type of thing, and thinking about, because I knew immediately, like, people needed the branding side of it. They need content too. Even if you consider it just creating content for them, for their social media or otherwise, you should charge for that. Like, that's a cost. That's a cost. It costs your time. So that was one. The second thing I started looking at was, okay, how do we add value? Like, what other ways can we add value? Sure, we can do marketing. Sure, we can do branding. But what else can we do? So the podcast also, we have a book series, best-selling book series. It's an anthology series where we bring authors together. We put them in a book that developed out of the podcast too. That was another revenue stream. We started doing PR. Why did we start doing PR? We started doing PR because, well, number one, we were doing it for ourselves. Number two, podcast guests and people that came on our show, they started asking for it. So we started that business. So that became another revenue stream. And then the next revenue stream became launching shows. Why do we start launching shows? Because people that were coming on the show asked for it. They said, wow, we like what you're doing. You obviously know what you're doing in launching a podcast. Can you help me? We said yes. And now to date, we've launched over 250 shows. So all of this goes back for people listening. You may be into production. You may not be into production. You may be into media. You may not be into media. Remember, my background was finance. So I didn't go to school for this stuff. That wasn't my background. I had to learn myself. And then when I got to a certain point in our team and, you know, hiring and growth, that we could hire others that were, you know, really good in these areas, we started growing those profit centers. So everything that I'm mentioning, all of this came out of the podcast. And if I would have been sitting around only thinking about how do I sell some ads, or how do I, you know, get the CPM up, you could spend a lot of time when there's a gold mine right in front of you, if you're willing to find other creative ways to add value to your audience and to your guests.
How have you gotten 6,000 interviews? What's your system for that?
You know, that wasn't by design. I'll tell you, if anybody goes into this business thinking that they're going to do that many interviews right that fast, it wasn't that. I think it grew pretty organically. So in the beginning, what I would do is and I still do it today. So if you've ever listened to Mission Matters podcast, then in the beginning, I say, hey, if you want to apply to be a guest on the show, go to our website, missionmatters.com. Well, I've been using that call to action since the beginning. And what happened is more people came, more people applied, more people came. And before you know it, the demand, I look at this all as supply and demand. So the more people that want to be on the show, well, there's only one supply in terms of this show and my voice. I mean, me, right? There's obviously other shows in our network, but that's how it started. It started just by people asking to come on little by little. And then it grew, demand grew. And now, you know, every year, as I mentioned in the opening, this year I did over 1,500 interviews. And speaking of profit centers, I don't think I went on this one. I mentioned this one before. One of our other profit centers. So speaking of being creative and figuring out ways to add value, we started an event side to our company, and we've done this last year, I think over 50 events. And many of those events, I'll host panels, I'll do interviews. Those are for our events. And then also we'll do, I will go out and I will promote other people's events, and I will do live podcasting at their events. So for example, I'm doing the Las Vegas Investor Conference in Las Vegas in early December. That's an example of a client that, you know, they had a need. They need somebody to interview their VIPs, their sponsors, their keynote speaker. They want to create content around that. They want it distributed. They want people to know about their conference. They want to drive traffic. Well, I can help do that. That's value that we can provide in exchange for what? A fee. Of course, it's a business. So that's another profit center for those that are listening.
Very interesting. I love it. How many shows do you put out a week, or what do you do? What's the system?
So I host currently 8 different shows, and all the shows are different niches. So we have a business show, we have an entertainment show, an innovation show, which is more like the tech side of things, a startup garage show, a marketing show, a luxury and lifestyle show. We have a money show, of course. And then, so what is, you go down all of these different niches, each one. So depending on what events and what we're covering, we fill them up. So essentially, in any given week I'm doing, depending on the week, I mean, some weeks I travel more than others, but let's just say on average, I'm doing anywhere between, I don't know, 30 and 50 interviews a week. And those are put out daily. So on the different shows, so daily, sometimes maybe one particular show doesn't get an episode that day, but they're normally put out daily or multiple per day. And depending on the cadence and depending on the season, but our aim and our goal and the way we look at it is that it does nobody any good if it's not out there so people can listen to it. So we try to get them out as fast as possible. And the next week's always filled already anyway. So we're never hurting for that.
How many are on your team altogether, Adam? How many people does it take to produce Adam Torres?
A little over 35 people now. So 9 years later, it's been, you know, and I'm very proud and of our team. We've had some of our editors have been with us since really the beginning. The second editor I ever hired, I think it was like 6-7 years ago, maybe a little bit more. He's still on the team, and our editors and everything else. So it's in-house. And I'll tell you though, it's been really good, and they've surpassed me, like, for sure. Like, in the beginning, I was the one editing. I like, believe it or not, this is what I used to do in the beginning, because I do like anywhere between, my record's 91 interviews in a week, and I used to do over 70 every week for a long, long time. But it got to the point to where I was trying to get so many done that my process, it was insane. It was audio only interview, just like the one that we're doing right now. And I'd be doing the interview with one headset on my right ear talking, and I'd be listening with an earbud on another monitor to the last interview, and I would be editing it real time while I was conducting the next one. And I got good enough to where by the end of the day, all of that day's interviews were already distributed, and maybe I was working on the last one at the end of the day. That's when I was good. Now I'm a part-timer. I'm not doing 70 interviews a week now. I'm only doing like, you know, 30, 40, 50.
And how long is an interview for you? Is that 30 minutes or an hour or 5 minutes?
Depends. I do all different interview types. And what I mean by that is video. I do live. I do in person. I do in front of a live audience. I do in studio, not in front of a live audience, in studio, in front of a live audience. I mean, all of the above. So it just depends on the format. It could be anywhere between 15 minutes to an hour. I've never really done like the Joe Rogan thing, you know, 2-3 hours or anything like that. Not that I've been against it. I've just never explored that territory. I don't know if I can keep attention that long, honestly.
So how long do you prepare for each interview?
I like, 20, so my seconds? Process, no, my process is a little, it depends on the type of interview. So some interviews I'm doing a pre-call for. Some interviews I'm not. Some, and it really depends. Some are, if I'm, you know, I'm going in front of, you know, 500 people for something else, then it, you know, it's going to take a meeting or meetings to prepare. But I'll tell you my philosophy around it. So, and kind of where I got my process in my sweet spot, if you will. So if we think about somebody like Larry King, when he went into an interview, like, he didn't know anybody about anything really about the person, like, unless it was his friend or somebody super famous. But for the most part, he didn't know. He knew as little as possible about the guest in terms of his process. And one of his things that he was known for is kind of like learning real time and being like an, you know, the everyday guy, right? Like on the side of the everyday person. So he skewed on the part of, I'm not saying not prepared, I just mean he really wanted to kind of learn actively while he was in the interview. And I remember him saying, like, I remember watching the recap of him interviewing Gary Vee. It was hilarious because he obviously had zero idea who Gary Vee was, even though Gary Vee was already pretty big, which is okay. I just mean that attests to what I've heard and read about his process, that was accurate. On the other side of the scale, you could think about somebody like a Oprah or a Howard Stern, where they have people researching their guests. I mean, they want to know what you had for breakfast. Obviously, that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but they want to know they want to know everything about that person that's about to be in front of them. And Howard Stern prides himself on picking out something that's going to like wow the guest. That the guest is going to be like, wow, I can't believe that you knew that. How did you know that? Right? He loves to freak people out in those moments. I would say that I'm somewhere in the middle. Like, I don't want to be clueless about my guests. I definitely want to have some background. I want to know who they are. I want to know a little bit about them, but I don't want to know everything. Like, I don't want to, like, if I don't, I learned pretty early on that I like, you know, I can't, if I ask you a question and I know all of the answer to that question, it's really hard for me to feign interest, you know, like I can't, yeah, I understand. Like, I don't get it. I want to actively learn too. So I'm kind of like in the middle for the prep.
What makes a good interview?
I think to have a good engagement with the guest, like to make that connection. Like, I feel like when you're in flow and you have a great connection with the guest, they're going to give you some things maybe that they haven't given another host or said when they were in another show. Like, if you can make them comfortable, if you can make them want to share, if you share just enough of yourself to make them be willing to share, I think it can create a great cadence and you can create something really unique. So that's from the host side. From the guest side, what makes a great interview? For the podcasting platform specifically, I would say storytelling, like not probably in all platforms, but especially podcasts. If you're going with audio, it's a passive listening experience. You're not necessarily, even if it is video, podcasts, I feel is still better. It's still a passive kind of listening experience. So you're not like sitting in front of like a big screen, like a movie where it has your attention and the graphics can do the work or the visuals can do the work for you. For a certain percentage of time, or the audio can do the work for you with sound effects. For podcasting, it's going to be the story. Like somebody's, you know, at the gym, somebody's driving their car, they're taking their kid to the school, they're like maybe in bed and they're getting ready to go to bed and they're listening to their favorite podcast. That story, that hook is what's going to keep them listening and it's what's going to keep them coming back, especially if you're a guest. Like you'd be so lucky. Got podcasts, guests ask me many times, like when they're thinking about how they should prepare, I tell them, I want the story that you've told a million times. That's the one I want. That sounds good. It's rehearsed. You're almost tired of saying it. You've said it on 1,000 other podcasts. The reason I want that one is because it's good. First off, you're going to tell it pretty good. Second off, you'd be so lucky if somebody actually remembered your story and they were like, oh, I remember he said that on another podcast. You'd be so lucky. Then they'd be calling you what? Like, think about it, like Les Brown, Tony Robbins, Oprah. They've been telling the same stories for 30, 40 years and we love them. Like you'd be so lucky somebody remember your pocket story, so to speak.
That is very true. Very, very true. Your pocket story. I hadn't heard that one before.
I made it up. I make up words sometimes. I know. I just say I keep it in my pocket.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a real term. You know,
yeah. You got to have more than one in your pocket. You got to have a whole cadre of stories. So
that's true.
What's your favorite story, Adam?
What story jumps to mind? Oh, my favorite for sure. I think I get way too much credit for doing a bunch of interviews. And maybe at this point, sometimes people think that maybe I'm a little seasoned in this business. But talent's subjective. I tell people, like, so I was telling my friend Matt, he tells me I need to stop telling this story, but I'm telling it. He's like, man, you've done all these interviews, you've done like 5,000, 6,000 interviews. You've been having this conversation for a while. And I said, yeah, but you say it's good. I argue I might be the world's worst podcaster because I'm not a household name and I've done over 6,000 interviews. So what gives? So I loved it. And he said he's going to start a, he's going to start a fan club. It's going to be worldsworstpodcaster.com. He's going to put my face on it. He cracks me up.
Well, that is quite an honor. Congratulations.
Right? Thank you.
I love him, Matt. That's a good quality friend. I like him.
Right?
Yeah, right. I know a guy that can make him disappear if you want.
Right?
Adam, how do we find out more? Follow online. Continue with Mission Matters.
Yeah, I'd love for you to just connect with me on Instagram. That's the easiest way. Ask Adam Torres. There's a link there, a link tree. You'll see it and you can get everything. Definitely pick up a copy of the book, 1 Billion Podcasts. There's so much more in there I didn't give you, including how to more monetization strategies, more mindset, even a legacy, the concept of legacy and what's next and why it matters for you to participate in the storytelling of legacy really making events. So again, just go to Instagram, ask Adam Torres. If you got a show idea or something like that you want to pitch, love to hear it. Just send me your pitch, shoot me a DM. And other than that, in the link tree, you'll see links to, I believe we give out more free content than any company of our size on the planet. There's free eBooks, there's other books you can purchase, of course, but a ton of free stuff, free content, and I'd love for you to connect with the platform.
Thank you so much, Adam. Great stuff.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I'm glad I finally made it on.
Yes, finally. We are out of time, but you know what we do. That's right. We come back tomorrow. Be safe, take care, and go make $1 million. We get 10%.